You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 353 of the Columbia Calling podcast. Yes, we've been going from strength to strength this year. And if I'm not mistaken, we've been able to put out a podcast every single week of the year. But correct me if I'm wrong. It certainly feels like it. But I have to say, in 2020, the podcast has kept me sane through this challenging time. And I've really enjoyed it. And I think that comes across. And I hope that those of you out there listening as well have enjoyed it too. Certainly the numbers have increased, which would suggest that that's a yes, not just because we've got the right people on the show or the right people are saying, you know, fascinating things that keep you tuned in. So I would like to say thank you, of course, to Diego Franco last week of pianomovil.com for his very expressive and admirable work that he's done there with this charity going around rural Colombia, parts of isolated Colombia, with a grand piano and other musicians. Of course, Miguel Cuadros, episode 351, the historian in Bucaramanga. We put together a bunch of theories, I think. If Yepes's goal had stood in 2014, that goal in Fortaleza against Brazil, could it have had outcomes and on perhaps the politics in the country? And of course, please do not accept drinks or leave your drinks unattended in Colombia. Episode 350 with Kevin McCaffrey. He details the horrifying story of being drugged and robbed under the effects of scopolamine. That's burundanga to some of you as well. So great episodes we've had of late, and this is no different. This week, our guest in segment three is the intrepid freelance journalist Joshua Collins. You might know him as Invisibles Muros on Twitter. Of course, he's always at the front lines, very much risking life and limb as a freelancer to get the story and tell the tale as it is on the ground. Boots on the ground information. He was there on the bridge between Venezuela and Colombia when the aid trucks were being burned after the Richard Branson concert and that famous statement by President Duque that this was the equivalent of the Berlin Wall coming down, that Maduro's, Venezuela was going to be freed from Maduro. So we'll be talking to him. Of course, he was down in Quito for a week-long period, reporting on the indigenous protests in Quito. And here in the N21, the November 21 protests and demonstrations in Colombia. He's always there. And so we look forward to hearing more stories and, supporting Joshua Collins in his quest to tell the right stories from the ground, the voices of the people. And so, of course, as I always ask, we have a Patreon campaign. You can sponsor us for as little as $2 a month. Just sign up for patreon.com, Columbia Calling. You'll find us. Those of you who commit to $25 a month and stick with us for a few months, in early 2021, you will receive some Columbia Calling merchandise direct to your homes. That said, I've also set up a store on bonfire.com. That's bonfire.com. Look up Columbia Calling. There are t-shirts, mugs, and hoodies available for purchase to support the Columbia Calling campaign. The Vote for Monty t-shirt is about our endorsement of my dog, Monty the Weimaraner, to run for president in Colombia in 2022. I'll sign off now, leave you in the capable hands of Emily Hart with this week's newscast, and then we'll be back with Joshua Collins of Invisibles Muros talking about his work as a journalist in the region. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
I'm Emily Hart, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for the week of November 30th, 2020. Colombia has given the go-ahead to Ecopetrol for its first fracking pilot. Drilling is expected to start in the second half of next year in Santander. It's part of a process to ascertain if the technique is viable for exploiting crude oil and gas fields on a larger scale. The move comes despite the Attorney General's declaration that Colombia is not ready for these procedures, not least because of negative effects on human health and contamination of ground and surface water. More pilots are, however, already in the planning and application process. Human Rights Watch reported that the deaths of 24 inmates of La Modelo prison in March were intentional. The deaths occurred during a riot over conditions during the early outbreak of coronavirus. 107 were injured in the same unrest. There has been no investigation or national justice for the deaths, despite evidence of extrajudicial execution during the riots. Last Wednesday was International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, seeing countrywide events and demonstrations. Local group Sisma Mujer reported that from January to September 2020, 88 women were murdered by a partner or ex-partner in the country. The report also revealed that, following partners or ex-partners, the major perpetrators of sexual violence against women are state officials. Members of the armed forces, the police, judicial officers and officers of intelligence services, followed by members of organised crime groups. In third place are custody personnel, in fourth are members of private security. The pandemic has led to a decrease in the reporting of incidents due to the difficulties that women have had in accessing official services during confinement. This means that official records do not necessarily show the extent of violence during the pandemic. The battle between taxis and ride applications like Uber and Didi continues in Colombia. A national taxi strike took place last week in various cities across the country, demanding action to protect the traditional yellow taxi from app-based services, which undercut their profits. Recreational marijuana use has been approved in an initial debate in the first committee of the Senate. The bill will now be debated in plenary session, though earlier this month, the House of Representatives sunk a similar bill by 102 votes to 52. Colombia is suffering an unusually extreme rainy season. The winter has affected 12 departments, leaving at least 26 people dead and 20 more missing. More than half of those affected are in Bolívar, Chocó and La Guajira. Even more concerning is that, according to the National Climate Agency, the rains may extend until May next year, due to the phenomenon La Niña. Colombia has now seen 1.3 million cases of coronavirus, with 37,000 dead. The First Lady of Colombia tested positive for the disease last week. The Colombian government has announced the procurement of enough vaccines to reach more than two-thirds of its most vulnerable population. Health workers, older adults and those with comorbidities, about 15 million people. Another 5 million vaccines will be purchased bilaterally, through negotiations with pharmaceutical companies such as Pfizer, with whom the government is now in talks. Several doubts remain, including which of the various available vaccines Colombia will access, when they will arrive in Colombia, and how and when the rest of the population will have access to a vaccine. Last week, a judge in Colombia renewed the requirement for a negative coronavirus test for those entering the country. Travellers wishing to enter Colombia now again need to show a negative PCR test. That was the week's newscast, and now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is the third segment of episode 353, and I said our very special guest this week. He's a journalist. He's on the streets. He's gonzo. He's incredibly popular on Twitter. He's here in Bogota. His name is Joshua Collins, originally from Texas, but grew up pretty much most of his life in Brooklyn. And we're going to talk about a bit of his work here in Colombia and the region, because really, I mean, you've been... Welcome on the show first, but I want to say, Joshua, I am a huge admirer of your work because you get down into the dirty of journalism. You're down there on the ground where the tear gas is smoking you out and you're looking for a way to get the stories out there. So welcome on the show. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, thank you so much. And that means a lot. I've been following your work as well and also a huge fan. So it's... it's touching.
Thank you very much indeed. Very kind of you to say so. But I'm nowhere near what you're doing now. You know, I'm a family man, two kids. I think were I not in the same situation, this situation, I might be out there, on the bridge at Cúcuta, like in January 2019 when you were there. I might have been a little bit more in depth and let's say embedded in the demonstrations here in Bogota around November 21st last year, and I might have even been in Ecuador, but you were in all of them, and you've really got, you know, you've really gained a name for yourself as getting into the thick of the action. So tell us a little bit, I mean, because you have no formal background in journalism, but you are, I mean, what can we say? You're an unbridled reporter. You are. It's almost conflict.
I wouldn't go that far. But yeah, so when I was starting out, because I didn't have any kind of formal education or contacts, what I did have though was I was there, and that started when I was living in Cúcuta on the Venezuelan border back in the beginning of 2018, when media didn't care much about Venezuela, at least international media. Mm-hmm. And since then, the reason I've been able to get work is that instead of making calls from a desk in Bogota, like, I'll actually go to conflict zones. I'll go to protests. I'll go to riots. And I think that that's really underrepresented in English language media. Like, so much of the reporting in Latin America is desk work, right? Which is great. And I have absolute respect for people who do that. But that's because I didn't have those contacts, and because I didn't have a pedigree university training, I sort of had to find another way and learned on the streets.
Yeah. And so you decided, Cúcuta, that's where I want to be. The border city, a Colombian border city overlooking, you know, the frontier, the river there with Venezuela. That's where I'm going to cut my teeth. That's where I'm going to file from.
Yeah, I kind of ended up there by accident after a failed love affair. And at the time, I was probably the only English-speaking reporter on the border. Mm. And that was before 2019 brought a lot of international focus to Venezuela. And so at the time, I had an apartment, so I didn't have rent. And I was able to survive as an extremely poorly paid freelance writer. And that's kind of where I cut my teeth and learned how to do journalism.
It's pretty cool. I mean, we've seen your bylines in a few things. Most recently, I've checked out stuff in the New Humanitarian. Where else have you published?
I'm published with Vice, Al Jazeera, and, you know, a bunch of one-offs with various groups. Some stuff here in Bogota, mostly in English. I guess New Humanitarian, Al Jazeera, and Vice have been kind of my main clients for the last few months.
Right, good indeed. I mean, because I've got through. I'm kind of on the other side. I just can't be bothered to pitch. I can't be bothered to explain the importance of a story and convincing.
Yeah.
But if you're there on the ground, there's a lot more color that you can, you know, actually.
Sure, kind of some added value, right?
Definitely. So now I recall reading a piece on Medium, because you publish on their stuff that I guess you can't get into in the mainstream publications. But were you held in Venezuela for a bit?
I was. I was detained by SEBIN, the intelligence agency of Venezuela, for a little bit less than a day, like 20 hours or something.
Nice. Very courteous people.
Not recommend.
So what, I mean, I assume they threw the accusations of being CIA.
So I was working on a story for Al Jazeera about gasoline smuggling across the border, which I'm sure you're familiar with, yeah. But maybe listeners aren't. At that time, gasoline was effectively free in Venezuela. So a huge amount of contraband comes across the border where smugglers will sell it in Colombia for an almost infinite profit, right? So I was working on a story about that in Guajira as part of a trip along the border, which is like the northern part of the Colombian-Venezuelan border. And I was working with a Venezuelan journalist, and I thought that I was in the Colombian side of the border, but a Venezuelan National Guardsman came up to me, explained that I was in Venezuela. I apologized and started moving away, and they detained me. And when the journalist I was working with came to try and talk to them, they detained him as well. And when they found our cameras and pictures of various points along the entire border, because we had just finished a trip from Cúcuta to Maicao, they accused us of espionage and terrorism. So the terrorism laws in Venezuela are really vague. People have been charged with terrorism for attending opposition protests. It's a really kind of blanket law, right? So originally they were asking for $10,000 to release us. Yeah, but my partner went, he told them, look, I'm going to go get the money. It was, he was terrified because he thought they were going to send us to a political prison in Caracas. And neither of us would fare well in that situation. Him being charged with treason and espionage and me being charged with terrorism and espionage. And the gravity, he impressed the gravity of the situation on me. He's like, look, they're not going to kill you. You're a gringo. He's like, but they might send you to political prison and you probably won't survive that. He's like, so he convinced them to let him go back to Colombia in theory to raise the money. But instead of raising the money, he took my phone and left me isolated for about 20 hours total, about 18 hours after he left, in a cell in the desert of Guajira. And I wouldn't say they are interrogating me, but they would come in every few hours and ask me lots of questions. Like, did I have military backgrounds? Like, why? You have to understand that this was last August, yeah. 2019. Yeah. So the tension between the United States and Venezuela was a lot higher than it is now. If you remember, some of the people in the administration, such as Bolton, were kind of fainting at possible armed intervention. But my partner, when he got back to Colombia, instead of trying to raise the money, which would have been impossible because neither of us have that kind of money, he alerted the American embassy. He called Colombian officials. He called the YU, the indigenous government in Guajira. He had my phone, so he called every editor that I've ever worked with. And within 5 or 6 hours, a number of media outlets were trying to get information from within Venezuela through their contacts and communicating with people within Venezuela that if they didn't release me, they were going to publish the story that SEBIN, the intelligence agency, had kidnapped an American. So they ended up letting me go after about 20 hours, and they kept my cameras, and I wandered back across the border, and Colombian military drove us to the northern coast in Riohacha, and it could have gone along a lot worse. I was very lucky. But the sad part about the story is that the journalist I was working with living in exile now. When I was leaving Venezuela, they were telling me that I'm very much a persona non grata. I'm not welcome. And furthermore, they knew where, I'm not going to say his name on your show. They knew where my partner was living in Venezuela. They knew who his girlfriend was. They knew who his grandmother was. They didn't actively say that there would be a problem if he came back, but the message was pretty clear. And he's been living in Colombia in exile since then.
Yeah, it's the situation, and this, I mean, I would say it's a de facto, well, it's a police state, isn't it? They have all the information there in Venezuela. Everyone informs and everyone else. And I'm curious that, you know, let's say there's 20 hours that you're being detained, I would imagine, in a kind of concrete cell in the Guajira Desert, you know, dusty Guajira Desert. What's going through your head? I mean, you know you can't get the $10,000. You might go to a political prison or a prison for political, let's say, inmates. And at the same time, now the stories are going to the editors in the U.S. that you've worked with. So they're now looking for contacts in Venezuela about to run the story. You're on the cusp of becoming the news, not reporting the news. And that's always a great fear, isn't it, I think?
Yeah. I mean, I had no idea any of this was going on. So I wish I could say that I had some tough guy story to tell you, but mostly I was just trying not to pee myself. Because when they would come in and talk about those prisons, they would tell me these horror stories, like these open-air prisons where the guards are the ones who are locked up and the prisoners are allowed to walk around. And it's incredibly dangerous if you don't have connections. And I've talked to some of the people in my years on the border who have been in those prisons, and their stories about, you know, forceful interrogation are not exaggerations. Those things happen. So I was just terrified.
Okay. Well, you know, fortunately it all worked out for you. Not so much for your colleague, but at least,
yeah.
He has his life. I mean, you know, he's not been thrown into a bottomless pit somewhere in Venezuela. And if we weigh things up, you know, he's probably a lot better off than a lot of people who
definitely have
been through similar situations there. And so, I mean, you've reported a lot. And of course, one of the big, big events, January, as we mentioned, January 2019, when our President Duque gave a motivational speech or some somewhat interesting speech, declaring that the fall of Maduro was imminent and it was as significant as the fall of the Berlin Wall, uniting East and Western Germany. And you were there on the bridge. You were there when it turned, everything turned a bit sour.
Yeah, in January of 2019, I had been pitching stories from the border for about 6 or 7 months in some limited success. And all of a sudden, that made editors interested. So I was doing a couple stories. I was also working as a fixer for two journalists from Caracas who didn't know Colombia. And yeah, that was kind of my first view of a real Latin American street brawl. I had seen protests in Bogota before. As you know, the student protests sometimes get pretty rowdy. They like to fight with SMED. But this was a different level. Like by the end of the day, there were firebomb throwing protesters that were engaging with colectivos on the border who were shooting back with live ammunition. It was utter and complete disaster, as a lot of people predicted, and ultimately ended up being this kind of televised massive failure. And I think was pretty embarrassing to Duque and the United States.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So did you see Richard Branson at there at any moment?
I did not see Richard Branson, although I did go to the concert.
Yeah. It wasn't very inspiring, the concert. It wasn't.
I mean, it was a nice concert, you know?
Okay. I mean, I actually have watched some of the other side's concert, which seemed to be a bit more edgy.
I wanted to go. They had all the colectivos were partying with Venezuelan punk rock bands.
Much more my scene is the punk rock band and so on, and then sort of crooners and ballads and I don't know, you know, romantic
pop stars.
But so yeah, I mean, you were there, and I mean, were you on the bridge when it really, really, really turned bad, when it went south and the like aid truck was set alight?
So there were, as you know, probably there are two bridges. Yeah. There's the Santander Bridge and the Simon Bolivar Bridge. I was on the Simon Bolivar Bridge for almost the entire day, and both bridges' trucks were set on fire, and both bridges were completely enveloped in tear gas. The foliage surrounding the bridges were set on fire at one point because of all the Molotov cocktails. People were throwing rocks from both sides. The Venezuelan National Guard was shooting rubber bullets and tear gas, and as I said, it escalated towards the evening into sort of like skirmishes all around the bridges. They say that, I don't remember the exact number, but close to 400 people were wounded on the Colombian side, and nobody has accurate information about exactly what happened on the Venezuelan side.
We're kind of used to that, but you haven't been hit by a rubber bullet, have you?
I've never been hit by a rubber bullet, thank God.
But you are now immune to tear gas.
Oh, I wish. I wish.
Because you must have taken a whole load in there on that bridge.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I met up with the reporters from Caracas that night, we went back to Cucuta, and all of us could barely speak between the raw throats from so much tear gas, but also gasoline fume, because the trucks were just billowing black smoke that had been started by Molotov cocktails for 6-7 hours on the bridge.
So how do you mitigate the effects of tear gas? I mean, some people say water, I've heard milk, I've heard, someone even has said that, you know, smoking weed helps. That's why.
The students here in Bogota swear that marijuana smoke helps, and that seems to be a common, or cigarette smoke as well, seems to be a common sort of home remedy. I don't believe that.
I find that hard to believe, but because, you know, I live not too far from the Pedagogica, the part of the Universidad Nacional.
Yeah, those guys love to play it.
Yeah, but it always smells of marijuana anyway, so it's not as if they're preparing for the attack. The whole place just smells of it.
But I've been tear gassed way more times than I can count, and for me, the most effective solution I found is saline solution.
Ah,
But if that's lacking, water is better than milk, or better than some people use apple vinegar too. But the thing about saline is it's the same. What is that with base and acid? pH. Same pH as your eyes. So when you introduce like milk or vinegar, you're going to be disorienting yourself further. And if it's milk, you're going to be risking infection. So it's better to just stick with saline or water.
Oh, well, I couldn't possibly think of a worse thing to put in my eyes. Well, actually, that's a lie. But vinegar, I mean, that's going to hurt.
Yeah.
That's going to hurt. I mean, think how raw your eyes are already. And then vinegar on top. No.
But it's a home remedy. Some people swear by it.
So do you carry saline with you when you're going to a demonstration?
Yeah, if I'm in a demonstration that I think has a possibility of turning violent, I carry saline, and I carry a small personal med kit. And also respirator, goggles, and a helmet.
Wow, you've really kitted up. This is proper stuff. Excellent.
I'm learning the hard.
So now tell us, now after Cúcuta, you were in Ecuador. So we know about Ecuador's, let's say, the indigenous protests that took place. You were right there at the front line, and some of the images that you captured there show not only how close you were to everything, but really have displayed quite what was going on. And there's one that I think most people will have seen, and I'm sure it's been stolen from you as well, is the kid at the front, and I guess he's got a helmet on with horns, and is he holding up an Ecuadorian flag or a shield or something?
Yeah, he's facing off against an entire riot squadron of Ecuadorian police by himself, and he's wearing a Huifla flag, the Andean flag of indigenous people.
Yeah. It's just an incredible one with the smoke billowing around. And then if you squint a little, you can see the security forces in the background.
Yeah, it was. He's one of the most inspiring human beings I've ever seen. I was choked out of the tear gas crowd and trying to retreat from it, as were almost all the other protesters that had called the response from that riot squad. But that kid, who I would guess is probably about 18 at the time, decided to hold his ground against a full Ecuadorian riot squad in the midst of a tear gas cloud. It was pretty inspirational.
But those riots in Quito, those were properly tough riots. That was, I don't know. If you were to compare them with what happened in November last year here in Bogota, what would you say? The Quito ones would win out over the Bogota ones? In terms of force, in terms of tear gas, in terms of, I don't know, how hardcore they were.
Yeah. It's difficult for me to compare that protest to anything else. So the indigenous people in Ecuador mounted this united nationwide protest. Mm-hmm. Now, people were shutting down highways to oil refineries across the entire country, but the physical presence was concentrated in the capital, and they were trying to attack the seat of government. Mm-hmm. And that's not an exaggeration. They were fighting police in the street, literally sometimes with spears. It was incredible, mostly with rocks and sometimes Molotov cocktails. I've never seen anything like that. And it was sustained over, I believe, 7 days. Yeah. And I was there for 5 of those days. And every day, 10 square blocks of the city were just completely enveloped in tear gas as this melee raged in the streets.
Well,
at one point, they had even managed to kidnap is not the right word. They had managed to capture like 20 police by surrounding them. It was incredible.
But see, that's the thing, is I think of those narrow streets in downtown Quito, and it doesn't lend itself, you can demonstrate, but to escape the tear gas and to escape authorities in their, riot gear, the kind of RoboCop type figures, it doesn't lend itself. I mean, and I think I read somewhere you got heavily tear gassed and were carried out by some of the indigenous protesters.
Yeah, at one point. I was tear gassed out multiple times. And it was interesting because as the protest evolved, there started to evolve a medical corps of protesters that were medical volunteers. They weren't associated with the Ecuadorian state in any way. They were just people that were providing on-the-spot medical attention to those who were either wounded or tear gassed. And they helped me out multiple times. Although one time when I had fallen out in the grass and was blinded and retching after escaping from a cloud, and this kid came up to me and he's like, "I'm going to help you." And I couldn't see him. And he's like, he started putting something in my eyes, and I realized it was dish soap, which was not very helpful at all. But it was nice of him to give me some attention, I guess.
Well, the thing is, I know so you've got these guys, it's almost, I don't know, let's call them the white helmets of Quito. I mean, you know, they came in and they offer you some sort of medical corps that's coming around. They're allowing, and I'm in support of the protest. I'm not in support of all the damage and everything else, but let's say they're allowing the protest to continue by, you know, mitigating the effects of the gas and everything else on the protesters. So of course they must be totally hated by the Ecuadorian authorities.
It was incredible. Yeah. The other thing that was, I've never seen a protest that was that unified.
Yeah.
For example, another thing that was happening a lot by day eight, by two or three of me being there, is there was almost no foreign press. It was all local press, and everyone hates the local press there because they think the local press was lying about what's happening. Mm. So they would prevent reporters from coming to the front lines of the protests, but they liked that somebody from the foreign press was there, so they would let me pass. And they were organizing, trucks would pull up with food that people would pass them along, like in a human chain, like a fire brigade, to the kids on the front line who were actively fighting the police. It was incredible. So it was a way for maybe people who weren't willing to be as extreme to support the protest effort. And it was all, none of this was planned. It all just evolved organically, because at the time, the protests enjoyed considerable support in Quito. It wasn't a very controversial, the violence was very controversial, but the cause was very widely supported.
Hmm. So when you are on a story, you're down there on the front lines, let's say, you're taking these incredible photographs, the media outlets are paying for you to get there, or you're going on your own dime?
Oh, I'm freelance. I go on my own dime. Wow. That was a funny trip too, because originally I got hired by Al Jazeera to do a video, a mini documentary of 5 to 7 minutes about the Quito riots, principally from the front lines, if you were. But they spiked my story 4 days after I arrived.
No way.
Yeah, it's true. And so that didn't quite work out the way I had hoped. But it was incredible because I managed to get a lot of stuff out through social media. And the fact that when I was there, I met one other English-speaking reporter, and he was from Telesur in Quito. And we ended up just kind of talking a lot because he was just curious what I was doing. And he was also one of the few people I saw that was continually allowed to get up to the front of the protests. And it was interesting. And there was a lot of curiosity because those protests, much like what just happened in Peru, were relatively unexpected. Like the protests started and then it just escalated immediately. By day two, it was almost a siege of the government buildings. So I think a lot of foreign media didn't have time to get there.
It's curious. I mean, there must be stringers there. There must be. But these are the Ecuadorian ones, which it was intense. Let's not lie about it. It was intense. And you were there. And of course, the social media, we're following you on Twitter. We're following you on Medium, whatever you write. You know, those of us who are interested in the arena that is, Northern South America, etc. We're following it, so we've got your information. And then you're back. Let's say you're back in Bogota, and November rolls round, and we have the demonstrations here. And before the great, let's say, suspension that we've been living in for the last 9 months. It feels like 9 years, but before the great suspension of life, we had these demonstrations, which did turn very ugly. And of course, it's pretty much the anniversary of the death of the 18-year-old student Dylan Cruz on the Calle 19 with like Cuarta, Quinta, or Septima somewhere. And then, of course, a few months ago, we had Javier Ordóñez at the father of two, the hands of the police. But I mean, you've been covering this, and I kind of think, of course, that Duque was spared further, the president was spared further distress, let's say, by the virus. It kind of steered everything away from the mismanagement taking place, and of course, people can't protest. But how did you feel before coronavirus hit? How did you feel when you were down there in the depths of the protest? Because you were there by the Universidad Nacional, where things get really hardcore. And of course, you went downtown to the Centro, to the Candelaria. I just stuck around in Chapinero taking some photos, and I was there with the people drumming, and it was all well-meaning and so on. But the Bogota protests, they were big.
They were big. And that was interesting for me because I go to a lot of protests. I like taking photos, even if I can't tell a story about them. So I was very, very aware of kind of how Nacho, that's what they colloquially call Universidad Nacional here. How those kids love to protest. Like, I love them for it. Right. So, but this was different, and I knew right away it was different because when I showed up, the entire university grounds were packed, and there were kids that had hundreds of them that had built homemade shields. They fully expected for the riot police to invade the university, which is exactly what happened. And they were originally on the first day of the national strike here. The march from Nacho was supposed to go to Centro. All of the marches were going to converge in downtown, in the seat of government, and put on a big, massive, peaceful display. That was the plan. The organizers from Nacho, when they realized how many people they had, they decided they were going to take the airport, which was, I was like, okay, this is different. This is like not something I've ever seen in Bogota. This is much bigger, much more well attended, and much more organized. And it was fascinating because this, I don't know how many people, I would guess maybe 30, 40,000, one of five marches that day, started walking down the highway towards El Dorado, the airport, and followed by police helicopters. And it was fascinating. There's jugglers and dancers and marching bands, and they were just ruthlessly attacked by hundreds and hundreds of riot squadron, the SMAD, the infamous riot squadron here in Bogota. And after that, it did turn violent. Like, kids started fighting back, throwing rocks. But the police were very clearly the aggressors. And my impression of not just that event on the highway, but also what happened in the far north and the far south of Bogota, is that if you think back to that time from the perspective of the Duque government, there had been massive protests in Bolivia. Ecuador had just happened a month before. Chile was in flames during one of the most violent periods of their protests. Duque talks a lot about the fear of communism from Venezuela and the infiltrators, as he says. I don't believe it happens at all. Well, 99.9% is not happening at all. And I think that they were just so worried about this huge public outcry that they decided to crush the protests with force. And that had the opposite of the intended effect, because when people saw how that happened, when they imposed a military curfew, the crowds the next day were bigger. And it was this sort of cat and mouse game for almost a month straight in the streets. I was going to protests every day. And it was sort of a rhythmic dance, right? Outside of maybe Chapinero, downtown or by Nacho or the other universities, people would protest during the day. Around 4 or 5, SMED would just start to launch piles of gas at the entire crowd, gassing everyone in the neighborhood. And things finally kind of started to lose momentum around December. As you know, Christmas is a huge deal in Colombia, and a lot of people leave Bogota. All businesses shut down. And that kind of put a damper on things. And the plan was to keep doing protests on the 21st every month. But then COVID happened, and that just completely killed almost all of the momentum for the social movement.
Definitely. I feel that they just, the government played it out as well, not knowing that the Christmas period would just, it would fizzle. You know, the actual cynicism of the government, but, you know, knowing well that it would. And of course, as you said, they had to be quaking for a while, though. What was going on in Bolivia, what's going on in Chile, what's going on in Ecuador, they had to be quaking. But, you know, it's that we call it a Latin American spring was, you know, that's an ill term, really, for what was going on. But at the same time, there is an undercurrent of unease, uncertainty, and this is prior to COVID, and of course, just total disagreement with the powers that be here. I mean, I know that, you know, we're polarized, everywhere's polarized, but to see that many people out on the streets, and it wasn't just students. When things went, you know, when it got violent, you know who's involved a lot of the time. But when the marches were, let's say, at their most relevant point, you had people of all generations and all social strata out there. That was what was so interesting. You know, pensioners, students, middle class, you saw them all there. And then, of course, when you see what's going on and you saw different, let's say, factions, what was happening on the Autopista Norte, what was happening, I think, in South in Bosa, that was curious, too, because I think you're giving an opportunity. It was like stamping out a fire in one place and having it pop up in another. I guess you call it like a whack-a-mole type thing. It wasn't going to be stamped out. And this ire, this anger is still here, isn't it? I mean, we saw protests this last week, the year anniversary, but it was nothing like last year at all.
No, but what we did have is in September, by far the most violent protests that have happened in Colombia in 50 years. So in the beginning of September, the protests were completely spontaneous. They were inspired by the police beating to death a father, I believe, of two, and somebody who had studied law in. They originally approached him for being drunk in the street after curfew, for violating lockdown measures, beat him ruthlessly in the street, tasered him repeatedly, and he died in custody an hour or two later. And that morning, completely spontaneously, with zero organization, people from all over the outer rings of the city started forming protests around the little police stations here, the CAIs, as they're called. And by nightfall, they had attacked over 80 CAIs. Yeah. And by dawn of the next morning, they had burned down over a dozen. During that conflict, police started shooting indiscriminately into crowds with live ammunition. And throughout the various parts of Bogota, but concentrated in Suba, the northern neighborhood on the outer ring, there were a dozen deaths and over 200 people injured. And that number continued to grow over the next 3 days. And it was so fascinating to me because usually you have student groups, you have unions, you have various syndicates that all kind of organize their own version of protests. They do a march, they go somewhere, and it's very orchestrated. But this was different. It was just people walking out of their house, walking a block, you know, walking 3 blocks, however far, to the local mini-cais, which are all over Bogota, and just verbally abusing police because there was so much pent-up frustration, especially in the outer rings. The poorer neighborhoods have such an antagonistic relationship with the police here. It's like, as you know, Colombia has a very long history of state violence. And just people that were sick of corruption, that were sick of, they feel like they are victims of a lot of these police forces, right? And to watch that all boil over completely spontaneously in the beginning of September was unparalleled. I've never seen anything like that.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? You have protests, I say, last year that come out of the deaths of social leaders. So we're protesting that. People are protesting because they want the peace courts to be adhered to. They're protesting because they don't want fracking. I saw people with signs saying they're protesting because they didn't want shark fin hunting or harvesting and so on.
I remember that.
Yeah, 35, 40 different things. But it's all been pent up again under this quarantine, and then this police brutality. And I, for one, feel less safe when I see police around here in Columbia. I mean, I've been harassed by police in New York. I didn't like it, but I didn't feel unsafe, of course. But here I feel unsafe. And I know that they destroyed in September some 40-odd streets because a friend of mine is a city councillor. He's like,
oh, okay.
Yeah, you know. So I mean, the Kai is one thing, but the streets were destroyed. So, but I'm tired of this, you know, age-old accusation of the ELN and FARC infiltration. Now, let's get this straight. There are opportunists and there is infiltration, albeit, let's say, on some occasions small, sometimes a bit greater. But this wasn't. This, for me, wasn't. This was the citizenry rising up in opposition and in disgust at what had happened. Now, you're on the ground. I was just watching the news because I'm not allowed out. But I was just watching the news. From your experience on the ground, what could you say in response to that?
Well, I'd like to back up just a second and respond to this idea about infiltrators. So every protest that I've ever covered in any country, the government always says the same thing. Hmm. These are outside infiltrators, or these are thugs, and we have to deal with them with a firm hand. They try to turn populists against the protests by amplifying these claims. I've seen it in Ecuador. I've seen it in Venezuela. I've seen it in Colombia. You saw it this year in the United States with BLM in the United States. And so this is just a tactic that all governments do. Now, sure, there are some armed groups with very small cells in Bogota that have committed violence before. And I don't doubt at all that some of them were taking advantage of the chaos to try to further their own aims. But let's think about this for a second, right? The idea that there was some kind of organized infiltration in a protest that, you know what I'm saying? The protest had only been going on for 5 or 6 hours when things really escalated. Yeah. And the idea that there's this shadow conspiracy so organized that it could respond to a spontaneous event by getting, you know, hundreds of thousands of people out on the street is laughable. It's a laughable idea. As for the mood, I spent most of my time in Suba, where one of the biggest massacres happened. And two girls that weren't even involved in the protests, they were just walking home, were both hit by gunfire when the police fired indiscriminately into crowds. And one of them died and the other is paralyzed. And so that ignited some very concentrated protests in Suba. And the reaction from the community was mixed. I think a lot of people disapproved of the attacks on the Kais, even though they identified with the anger of the protesters. So it was interesting to me because Gaitán is where that massacre happened. Yeah. And the community took over the police station and they turned it into a community, what they called a cultural center. They were giving away food and books and making speeches from the roof about how the way forward was through politics rather than direct action. But whether or not you agree with that doesn't really matter to me as a journalist, but it was super fascinating because you had people that disapproved of the attacks on the police, but that very much believed in the idea that the community needed to push back. They were trying to kind of rechannel that frustration and that anger. But as I said, the most impressive thing about the protests to me were just that their spontaneity. The idea that was completely unorganized says a lot about the pent up frustration, especially among the poorer class here in Colombia. For people who don't know, in Bogota, the suburbs are not nice. All of the wealthier or more middle class neighborhoods are more concentrated towards the mountainside or the center of the city, whereas the suburbs tend to be much more neglected economically and have a much more antagonistic relationship with the police. And that's where those protests were concentrated.
So I got, you know, we've got to wind this down, unfortunately. And I think my listeners could, you know, obviously just tune in to hearing your experiences and anecdotes of these, of your time, you know, reporting from actually, you know, on location in these protests. You are the journalist who covers the protests. But when you see, for example, like a week and a half ago, the issues, everything kicking off in Peru, and justifiably so, but when you see the issues kicking off in Peru, do you think, I've got to get on a bus, plane, whatever, I've got to get down there? Is it that kind of adrenaline hits you?
Yeah, by day two of the Peru protests, I was looking at flights. I was like, I can go. But it was just an exorbitance. The thing is, it's like, on that kind of short notice, because I don't have contacts with editors really in Peru who provide coverage on Peru for the most part. It's like, I go down there for what, a one article piece, that's $350. The round trip airline is more expensive than that. So I was unable to attend, but that was pretty inspirational. And also a very, just with a lot of popular support that effectively toppled the president.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And so, and also now, and finally, as I wind this down properly now, what do your parents have to say about you? You know, but it seems like you're on a ventilator of tear gas.
Yeah, I mean, my mom thinks it's kind of cute that I pretend to be a journalist. She doesn't really read much about what I write or follow my social media. I think that she won't really be convinced I'm a journalist until I'm wearing a suit and a tie on CNN or
Well, I don't think you're pretending. Let's get that clear. And I know that my listeners, they are definitely aware of who you are, and they know that you're not pretending. And I do see people, you know, pointing your Twitter handle out to others, you know, saying, this guy is always on the front line, read him. So there's no pretend going on here. There's no acting.
It's how I make my living. Yeah. I think my mother just kind of chooses to not understand it. I love and respect her very much, and she always thought I was crazy, so she lets me do my thing.
It might be better for her to not really know what you're doing.
Told her the Venezuela story. And
Well, and she didn't read the Medium piece?
No.
Okay, so this might get you in trouble.
That's possible.
Yeah, you know, it's easy. She could be, cooking or something, or you know, having people around. It could be on in the background, maybe. I don't know.
It's really fun.
Well, listen, I'm going to say thank you for your time and for these insights and your experiences, sharing them with me and with my listeners. For those of you who want to follow Joshua Collins, his Twitter handle is Invisibles Muros.
Yeah, Invisibles Muros. The self-published publication I have is Muros Invisibles, but that was taken on Twitter.
Okay. So that's
the easiest way to find me is just go to murosinvisibles.com. You can find Twitter feed. You can find links to all the stories I've published, also to the blog and the Twitter stuff.
Excellent. And so wherever there's a demonstration, you can almost place an easy bet on Joshua being there. And of course, then wait for the great articles that come out. So let me take this moment to say thank you so much for your time, for your insights, for sharing with us so unselfishly some of your really incredible experiences.
Thanks for having me on. I've been a fan of the podcast ever since I arrived in Colombia.
Oh, perfect. Well, there we go. Flattery, as I say, will get you everywhere. And I hope to read some more of your stories soon, because I know you're going off on another intrepid adventure. But we'll talk about that at another time, because I'm sure you can't talk about it. But this has been episode 353 of the Colombia Calling podcast. Thank you so much to Joshua Collins, journalist, for his for sharing with us his stories from the front line, let's call it. And we'll be back next week. I've got a few other people lined up for interviews that I'm always on the lookout for new people. So if you have anyone that you'd like or consider to be interviewed or have a conversation here on the podcast, always open to all sorts of suggestions. So that's me, Richard McCall, for the Colombia Calling podcast, episode 353, here in Bogota. Thank you again. Bye-bye.